Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello, darlings. I speak to you from the streets of Aberdeen. I am here for a gig tonight with Steps. Just come from 2 nights in Manchester, which was really fun. The gig last night was wicked. Loved it. And I'm on my own doing the thing I like to do where I Google the nearest or the best vintage shops in town and use that as a way to like get me out of the hotel and walking around. So I've been out now for about an hour, I think, maybe an hour and a half, poodling about. It's a very handsome place, actually, Aberdeen. I like it. And, yeah, bought myself a nice little turquoise sort of 60s-esque frock. And, oh, small chance I'm walking in the wrong direction when I'm talking to you. I'm going to look at my map while we speak. Let's see. Where is she? That wasn't me talking about myself in the next third person. That was me finding out where I have to be. I'm only 3 minutes from where we gotta be. Oh, great. I was actually going in the right direction. That's refreshing. I'm normally not. Whoa. It's actually quite cold here, like maybe 10 degrees, and I just walked past some girls in tiny little frocks. They looked young and they looked cold, but they looked sweet. This week's guest is a really lovely woman called Harriet Gibson. And Harriet is a journalist. And I read an article that she'd written. I think it was retweeted quite a few times because it was really beautifully written, all about her going through early menopause and her journey to motherhood. And oh no, it's getting windy. Rich is going to hate that. Sorry, Richard, in the studio. What, you're going to go past a busker in a minute as well? It's all happening on the streets of Aberdeen. Anyway, can you hear that? Well, that guy is having fun. I thought, oh, when I read the article, I thought, oh, I'd love to speak to Harriet for the podcast. She'd be brilliant. And then a couple of weeks later, I was doing a photo shoot with my mum. Oh, I might have to dip into a doorway. Rich is going to hate this wind on the microphone so much. It's going to make him very sad. Hold on. I can stand here. Does that work? Anyway, a couple of weeks later, I was doing a photo shoot with my mum for The Guardian. A really nice thing where they took a picture of my mum and I from about 35 years ago, and then we recreated it now, a kind of then and now thing. And we spoke to the journalist, and I thought, that journalist looks familiar. And afterwards, my mum said, oh, that's the woman from the article you liked. So I was like, oh my word. So I said to Harriet, I'd love to speak to you in the podcast. And she was a bit taken aback, I think, but also really chuffed. So anyway, she came around to mine, And now I'm going to play for you the conversation that we had, which was really wonderful. And I'd like to thank Harriet for being so beautifully open and honest about her experience, because I know that those conversations really do help people listening in to if they're going through something similar. Anyway, over to you, Harriet, and me from a few weeks ago. See you on the other side. What exactly are you up to at the moment?
That's a really good question. I go to Boots quite a lot and look at the skincare ranges. What do I do? So I was an editor at The Guardian for a while, for about 8 years, and then I left in July to, become a writer in some respects. I'm still sort of figuring it all out. I do a ghostwriting column for The Guardian still. And then there are a couple of other projects that I'm sort of working on and probably aren't ready to sort of say yet.
Yeah.
Just in case everything falls through and I look ridiculous. But yeah, I'm enjoying sort of exploring new things, and just getting out of the grind of working at a newspaper was great because I was exhausted, quite
really?
Frankly. Yeah. I just don't think I've got it in me to do that every day. And there are no sort of relaxed days. You don't get bank holidays off or anything like that. It's just full throttle every day.
And how long were you in that? Were you in that sort of cycle?
So I worked on the music desk for 4 years, and that was a daily, you know, I had to pump content into the ether for hours every day for 4 years. And then I worked for a weekly, which is quite sort of rigorous, but not as intense. You don't have to worry about George Michael dying on Christmas Day or anything like that. But yeah, it's good. And I don't know if it's because I've just had a baby, but all the menopause stuff, but it's just good to not have to be tied to getting up at a certain time and being really alert at specific times. I can sort of have periods where I'm a bit hazy if I need to be.
Yeah, and your little one is still really very little. He's only 20 months.
Yeah.
So do you feel like that has had a bit of an influence in wanting this maybe a different time? I suppose you've also had lockdown as well. There's been a lot going on, hasn't there?
It's a good question, because I actually put him in childcare an extra day when I left The Guardian. So I feel like I get less time with him, if I'm honest. But it is nice to be able to see him every day after nursery. And I think I'm probably a bit nicer to be around.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, happy mum, happy baby, that thing.
Yeah.
So probably benefits everyone in our house, I think, that I've done this. But I don't know. In a year's time, I might be terrified and pulling my hair out, but who knows?
No, I think, you know, if you have the ability to, I mean, we were talking, weren't we, before we started recording about being flexible and having a little bit of give and take with, you know, ebb and flow with the sort of parameters of how that all works. And it sounds like having done the sort of desk job aspect of writing, which must be a muscle you just have to keep flexed all the time if you're writing that much, that now it's quite a good time to kind of take stock. And you have been through a lot in the last little while that's given you lots of chances to take stock. And the reason I wanted to speak to you was quite a lot of nice serendipity involved as well. So I'd read the article that you published in June this year, which we'll talk about in a second. And I was really struck by it. And I forwarded it to my mum. I'm like, this is a really beautiful article. And then we ended up working together with my mum. And it took me a second for the penny to drop, because when I saw your face, I was like, I know that lady's face from somewhere. And then I was talking to my mum, and she's like, you know, that's the article you forwarded me. I was like, oh my goodness. So we did that really nice piece where she was talking to my mum, and I think it was the first one they did.
Yeah.
The Guardian. So it's a photograph of my mum and I that we recreated from when I was really little. They're really fun to do, those things.
Yeah,
they're very satisfying. And it's a nice interview that we had about, actually we spoke about quite a lot of things, but I suppose primarily about the relationship I have with my mum. But yeah, I was really so moved by your article, because, you know, there are so many ways to become a parent. And obviously, you know, there's one that is presented as the most easy option, but that's not the one that everybody gets given to them. So did you always want to be a mother anyway?
I think so, but it wasn't, I didn't have a burning desire. I wasn't sort of desperate to build a family, and I don't think I'm sort of enormously maternal in that way. I'm the youngest of three and I've always been the baby. So I was always a bit like, oh no, I'm going to lose that status now. If I have my own, I have to be responsible.
And are you the last one of the three to have a baby?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. They've both got two each, my brother and sister. My husband and I were, you know, we just got married and I knew at some stage I'd really like to have a baby. But I was having quite a lot of fun, truth be told. And I quite liked going out and I liked going on holiday and having fun. So I took it for granted entirely my fertility, because I think you often do, really.
Also, you were young. This is in your like late 20s, early 30s,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then I started getting some unusual symptoms, which made me question a lot of things. And then I eventually found out I wouldn't be able to have children, which then inspired me to sort of get on that path to figure out how to do it.
Mm.
Shall I fill in the gaps?
Yeah, well, either you can, or I'm just going to start asking like a ton of questions, basically.
You go for it.
So I suppose we should start at the very beginning of that journey, which is that, so you find yourself, looking back, you could see that the first symptoms were in your, like, so 28, 29.
Mm.
So you're getting a few feeling sweaty moments and you think you're just not coping very well with stressful situations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was, it was a very sort of aggressive heat that sort of was very prickly and coursed throughout my body very suddenly. It often happened when I was trying to get to sleep or if I had to have a sort of challenging conversation with someone. I felt it was like almost like having a lie detector test attached to me, because immediately my neck would just be like
everything gives
red.
Away how you're feeling inside.
And I was, you know, I'm a bit of a stress head. Well, I was anyway. And so I presumed it was me sort of trying to put a lid on my sort of very intense imposter syndrome at The Guardian. And I thought it was fine. I'd go on holiday sometimes and it would disappear. And I thought, it's just anxiety.
Yeah, but that sounds really natural if there were moments where it would go.
Yeah, totally.
And also that coincide with not being in the work environment or stressful situations in that way.
Yeah, and I still really don't understand what the connection is between that and the menopause. But, I mean, my periods were really erratic and that, since day one. So
yeah, was that an unusual thing?
No, it was just, it's always been very stop and start. Like I'd get them, my first periods would go on for 2 months and then I wouldn't get them. And, you know, I thought it, again, that was based on stress or mental issues rather than physical ones. So yeah, carried on regardless. And then I started getting really sad at really unusual points in my day. And I suppose it was the contrast between having a really lovely experience sort of with a family or with my friends, and it was offset by me just really aggressively crying.
Oh, no.
I'm laughing, I know, but it is kind of mad when I think about it, if anyone were to witness me doing it.
But did people witness that, or was it something that was quite secret?
I was really, really good at being sneaky about it. Because I think
sneaky,
it would
aggressive crying.
Yeah,
sounds noisy.
It was. Yeah, I think I've learned. I am quite good at hiding all of these things, because I didn't want to alarm anyone really, and because I didn't know why I was crying, I didn't think it was really worth me bringing it up with anyone.
And also, the thing I'm thinking as well is that it's extraordinary, really, that you can have what sound like really quite stark, really unpleasant symptoms and attribute all of it to stress. And actually, that sometimes is just what's happening. And I'm thinking, what a crazy situation most of us put ourselves in with things like you're saying about imposter syndrome. I feel like I can so relate to just going, well, I've just taken too much on and I'm stressed about this, actually. And I've always had a latent anxiety about a lot of this anyway. So sooner or later, it had to come to the surface. Whereas actually, that's a really, really stressful way to live with all that going on and not really, and just thinking it's just work and you just got to get on with it.
Yeah, it is bad, isn't it? And I think we're just sort of, I mean, it always ends in something quite dramatic happening health-wise if you don't address it. But I don't know, unless you're like really, really, really impaired, it doesn't seem worth bringing it up really, does it? And also hormones are so chaotic often for women anyway that you're like, oh, this is just, I'll just adapt to whatever hell my hormones have
yes
loaded on me today.
Well, actually, there's a line in your article that really stayed with me where it said something like, to survive the chaos of the female anatomy, you need a really sensitive, you know, wise, you know, presence in like a doctor or someone you find. But actually, I think quite often we don't find that person.
Yeah.
And when you first do go to see a GP or something, you know, there's so many stories, aren't there, of people just getting a fairly dismissive or tactless response. I mean, I know, you know, my mum, when she went to the doctor about her own menopause, the guy she saw was basically like, well, this is just sort of what happens at this age, so you've just kind of got to get on with that now. And she was like, hang on a minute, that doesn't sound right at all. But, you know, the fact that you'd even get to that stage in your life and still be sort of fighting to kind of have the conversation you actually need to have rather than the one you've been given is like,
I know,
quite extraordinary. But we can come on to that later because I think that's a whole other aspect, really. But so that's all building, and you get married in amongst these things happening. Is that right?
Yeah, well, yeah, they sort of, the crying happened after I got married. And then things really accelerated about 5 months after I got married, actually. I just noticed a significant shift in my brain and what I was able to do with it. So I lost all the agility that I once had. Not that I'm this incredible sort of raconteur or anything, but it was impossible for me to access words that I'd learned throughout my life.
Oh, that must have been horrible.
It was really scary, especially being a journalist or even interviewing people. It suddenly was very terrifying to sort of engage with even friends at work because I was worried that I would forget what to say halfway through a sentence. And my imagination was also really deadened by it. I think that's the sort of joy of life, having sort of nice sort of daydreams or even sex and stuff like that. It was all the sort of additional things in life that sort of keep you going was suddenly just everything got really muffled and a bit hazy. It's known as brain fog, which I think is quite a good description of.
Is that what it feels like then? So you just sort of haven't got the ability to kind of float off into anything.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a bit, I likened it to coming back from Glastonbury after 4 days. So
you feel a bit spent, a bit sort of rinsed.
Yeah, yeah, totally burnt out. And that's very stressful if your job requires you to be.
And it's lonely
articulate.
As well.
It's really, that's. I was incredibly lonely, and my husband is really supportive, but I was scared, and we couldn't figure out what was happening. And he would say, you just seem completely normal to me, but I knew inside it was all going weird. So then other symptoms started happening, like I was in a lot of pain in my joints. It was really, you get fidgety legs, so it's really hard to relax at the end of a night. And then I had insomnia, which I need a lot of sleep to function, and it wasn't happening. I would just be incredibly alert before bed and I'd wake multiple times in the night because of the hot flushes. So I'd begin every day just in a state of total panic because I knew I hadn't had enough sleep to just get me through the day with the brain fog on top of it. So at that point I was like, I need to see a GP. And they'd always been really great, my local GP, but I think we're only now sort of having more nuanced discussion about female hormonal health. So they did lots of tests. They thought I might be depressed, but I just was very conscious that it wasn't depression. And I don't know how, I suppose I know lots of people who have had depression, and this felt felt like an illness or a condition that wasn't strictly mental health. It felt like a full bodied, something is attacking me. So it was about a year or so of going back and forth to doctors, different doctors, until they sent me to an endocrinologist who called me in and said, look, we finally looked at these test results. It's the FSH levels and the AMH levels, and they measure how fertile you are, essentially. And he said, you've got a condition called premature ovarian insufficiency, which means you've got a less than 5% chance of conceiving naturally, and you'll need to be on HRT until your 50s, when you can eventually come off and, you know, your body just naturally is in a postmenopausal state. And he said it in such a sort of casual way that I was confused about sort of absorbing the news. I was like, oh, is maybe this is fine. And I had this sort of moment of sort of thinking, I need to say something, I need to question this. And I was like, well, I'll surely be able to do IVF. And he said, no, you don't have, your ovaries aren't responsive enough, so you'll have to get a donor. And yeah, it just suddenly detonated my brain, really. I just couldn't really absorb the information that was being given to me.
And you were with your husband at the meeting as well?
I was on my own.
You're on your own?
Yeah, because we'd been to so many appointments and it was just getting a bit exhausting. So I just went on my own and thought it would be another sort of dead end.
Well, that's a lot to take in.
It was, and my brain, it took about 4 months for my brain to properly grieve the news about the infertility. And I was sort of trying to address the menopausal symptoms. That was the most urgent sort of thing in my mind, is how do I get through my days with all these symptoms that are preventing me from being normal? But I rang my sister, who's my best friend, and I told her what had happened, and she immediately, without skipping a beat, offered to donate her eggs to me. And I was like, great.
Which cool. is such a... it's so beautiful, that.
It is.
And I love how completely instinctive that was for her as a response.
Yeah, it was gorgeous, actually.
That's such love, isn't it?
And, yeah.
So just thinking, when you're with the doctor and he said premature ovarian insufficiency.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did he use the word menopause then?
No.
And is that the same thing as menopause?
It's not. It isn't. No. We call it the early menopause because it sort of does have the exact same symptoms, but
right.
It's not. I don't know. I'm not really scientific, so I can't
really
explain.
No, I'm really just trying to get my head around it.
It's a really good question. Clever people on Facebook groups I sign up to can explain it, but I don't know.
I'll ask them.
Yeah.
Because I was just thinking as well that... whilst there's still a lot of mystery around menopause, I wonder if that would have helped your brain to hear a familiar word in amongst a lot of other words that are all new.
I did, once I heard that word, I was like, well, I'm going to tell people that. Also, because if you Google premature ovarian insufficiency, one of the first symptoms that comes up is dry vagina, and I didn't want people... I didn't want people going, oh, let me have a look at what Harriet's got, and going, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
She's having a rough time.
That little nod of tilted head, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And I just thought, yeah, people get it. People don't really understand what the menopause is, but they sort of get vaguely that they want to keep away from me maybe for a bit. So, yeah, I did use that language instead. But, I mean, what followed was, I sound so dramatic saying this, but kind of a massive existential spiral after that. Just in terms of my identity as a woman, I just... I still feel a bit confused by it all now, but I felt deeply sort of asexual and outsider, a bit of an outsider all of a sudden. And I was really unhappy. But also it was tricky because my sister had given this brilliant opportunity to Mark and I, so I was incredibly grateful for that. But I was sort of battling with these two sort of things at the same time. And things moved very quickly with the fertility treatment. We got an appointment with some brilliant doctors, and we just got tested to see how my womb was, to see if it would hold a baby, and it was fine. And I had to start on all these hormones to sort of get my womb ready. Mark had to jizz in a pot a bit. He was fine as well. And my sister was also, everyone was like fit and healthy. But it was more about, getting me ready for it. So I had to take HRT and it made me not feel good, actually. HRT is a brilliant, you have to take it when you're menopausal or have POI, because it's important for your heart and bone health. When you don't have enough estrogen, they're really at risk. So it's really essential. But you have to work hard to find the right stuff for you, because
and
it
the
can
dosage
also make,
it's really bespoke, isn't
really,
it?
Really, really bespoke. And I just had to take this stuff to get my body ready for the baby. So it wasn't really a time for me being like, but I also cry a lot. You know, it was like, let's just get the womb ready and then we'll figure out how to make me feel good in the long term. So yeah, that was about a year.
That's a lot to think about all at once. And I actually think I've already started thinking a little bit about what you're saying about your identity as a woman. I think particularly in our young lives, I don't think you realise how intrinsic the sort of aspect of fertility is to so much of femininity. I'm not saying whether or not you want to be a mother. It's not about being maternal. It's about, I suppose it's about like your sense of self. And I think it's just something that it's laced throughout so much of female culture without really even realizing.
Yeah.
I think about that being an aspect of what it is to be a young woman, even if that's not something you're prioritizing. But yeah, it's not necessarily even about having babies.
I agree. And I mean, I sort of feel like motherhood is really fetishized sometimes.
Oh, golly,
I think that was the thing that confused me a bit, because I never saw motherhood as, you know, I've never judged anyone for not having children, and I've never considered myself, in order to be a woman, I have to be a mother.
But totally agree. I think, and also I think some of the most maternal people I know don't have any babies.
Yeah,
and
I'm
and
exactly
vice versa.
The same.
I don't.
Yeah.
It's a really loose connotation in my head with that.
Mm.
But I think you're right, it is really fetishized, and I think it's a weird time. There's a lot of aspects of motherhood that I think are better now, in terms of there's just a lot more role models actually for being a different, for everybody's way of interpretation of being a parent. And I know that when I became a mum, I didn't really feel like I saw much reflected back at me what made me feel like I was doing, the sort of mum I wanted to be. But at the same time, it's taken really far with some aspects, and it's sort of, you know, the balloons and beige and aspect of, you know, like,
that
aspect is like, oh, I don't think that's me at all.
Yes, I relate to all of that, definitely. Just sort of looking at my body on a kind of daily basis, which I ended up not doing anymore because I was just, I just got very, just sort of disgusted with myself, if I'm honest. I was struggling to sort of look after myself properly, because it just takes quite a lot of energy to wash sometimes when you're low. And I felt really uncomfortable in myself. I felt very estranged from my body because it was, you know, behaving in a bizarre way. And also it had just been told it couldn't do this thing that you're brought up to believe is really essential as a woman, which it's not. But
well, also,
you know,
a lot of the side effect, the symptoms you're having are horrible. I mean, and they're right in your head.
Yeah, yeah.
They're affecting, you know, like the fact that you couldn't articulate things or feel imagination. Mm. As you say, those aspects of how we live are what elevates every aspect of just getting by. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
That's the fun stuff right there.
It is.
And I think I can imagine as well, when you've had such a diagnosis, that you'd be doing something fairly mundane and you just want to be like, you don't realise though, I'm going through all of this on the inside. You know, I look the same, but there's so much going on.
I know, I was like that, but I was really embarrassed to be, like, in retrospect, I was just really desperate for, I suppose, a conversation like this. I really, really wanted to tell everyone all the time, because I just was, I can't process this on my own. I felt really, I mean, I went to the Brit Awards when I was a music journalist, and had a few drinks, and then went to an after party and saw a friend I hadn't seen for ages. And she was like, Hattie, I've spoken to Tim, I've heard about what's going on. And I was like, it's awful, isn't it? And I sort of started unloading all my sort of trauma onto her. And she was like, oh, no, I'm really sorry. I meant Tim's cancer diagnosis. And I was like, oh, yeah, sorry. That's probably more of a priority than me sweating quite a lot. So I was just very needy. And
that's not needy, because what you're doing, what you're going through, is a really big deal. And you know, and I bet when you were visiting Dr. Google, I bet a lot of roads led to cancer anyway.
All of
so that's in, yeah, because that's where all Dr. Google always takes us first.
It's true.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But sorry to sort of misquote you back at yourself, but there was a line about talking to people and menopause not being quite dramatic enough to actually get from people what you really needed to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're talking, like, if you're like sort of, you know, if you're at a party or speaking to someone and you shared what's going on and they just kind of go, oh, I'm really sorry, that sounds awful. And then just sort of move on to the next, be like, no, this is, yeah, it's worse than that. Next level up, please.
That's so true. I think, well, my mum was certainly incredibly stoic with her menopause, and I just remember her being slightly hot one Christmas. But maybe also menopausal symptoms aren't always really savage, but it wasn't talked about really. So understandably, people didn't understand the level of maybe difficulties I was having. And it wasn't until that article came out that people, like, I had no idea it was that, all of that. I thought it was just a bit of sweat because I had a desk fan and stuff. So people knew that was a symptom. But yeah, I don't know.
You did find it at a community, though, didn't
I did,
you?
Through yeah.
Daisy?
The Daisy Network, yeah. I went to, how did I? I think a doctor suggested I spoke to a therapist who specialised it and who then suggested I signed up to this network called the Daisy Network, and they've got a Facebook group and it's filled with other women who are going through something similar. And they are really great at just talking about sharing sort of HRT stories and also just being open about what they might be facing symptom-wise. But then I sort of did egg myself on, I think, sometimes. If I was having a really bad time, I would just find some sort of weird message board somewhere else and I'd get really stuck into other people's difficult times and I'd wallow in it a bit.
And that's quite tiring as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
You sort of wander deep down those corridors.
Yeah. I suppose I was just really lonely and I needed to connect to someone. So these poor women were the ones to do it. And they've been really useful, because there isn't enough information really in most GPs because they're probably understaffed and they don't have, you know, specialists working for them. So you can sort of get some help in terms of how to treat yourself, really.
But it's also quite a small percentage of women that go through something like this, isn't it?
Still? Yes, 1% of women under 40. But, you know, since that article came out, I've spoken to so many people that I know who've gone, I've been diagnosed with that. I wonder if it's more, and I don't know. I think it's
actually, you know what, that's right. I mean, they only get that percentage through people that actually figure out what's going on.
That's the thing. I think we're really used to, women are used to living through quite a lot of,
yeah, and you could easily have just discomfort. Been put on antidepressants.
Yeah, yeah.
Go all around those roads before, you know, realising that that's not really getting to the root of it.
Totally.
And I think that's the problem with hormonal stuff, is that it's lots of strange things that you don't necessarily join the dots up of. I mean, nothing like yours, but I have an underactive thyroid, and that's really.
Yeah.
Oh, high five.
But that is bad. That is not good for energy and
no.
All
and
that.
But that again, like all the dots of that, they're all over the place. So you can think, well, I mean, I didn't realise because I just had a baby and I thought, well, that's why I've got extra weight and I'm really knackered and feeling a bit sludgy and a bit Eeyore. I didn't really understand that it might be anything different. And I think there's a lot, like, your hormones in your body are crazy for how they can affect everything. Mm-hmm. And the glasses through which you see everything. And I think menopause in general is something that I don't think is being talked about enough. It's such a significant thing and can make so many women feel like they're going absolutely crazy and aren't keeping up with themselves. And it sounds like there's a lot of anxiety that can be associated with the things that you used to find fine. And then my mum said that she found suddenly, like, going to the airport, she'd just be really nervous about travel out of the blue. Like, that was never really her before. And suddenly, like, just made her feel really sort of lots of palpitations and... Yeah,
like really physical, because I'm a warrior. I don't have, you know, clinical anxiety, but I was always a real warrior and over-preparer. But it was the physical feelings of anxiety, so the heart palpitations and pain, and my left arm would go completely numb, which apparently is connected to it. So, yeah, it was quite trippy, really.
Mm.
Just before I forget, I have to say the other people who've got underactive thyroids, Desiree.
Okay.
Gigi Hadid and Sean Ryder.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
So we're in a cool club.
That's great. I'll DM them later today.
You should. sorry. Derailed that.
No, sorry. Well, if I ever find myself sat next to them on a dinner party,
I've
got the icebreaker. Did you take your thyroxine this morning? Actually, I get in trouble with my mum quite a lot because I'm really bad at remembering to take it. I know. It is really bad.
It's really bad.
It's awful. But, and you'd think after 17 years of taking a medicine, But yeah, it's not. I remember talking to another friend about something she's taking. My mum was in the room and I was like, oh, don't worry, just take it when you next can. It's like me with my thyroid. My mum just piped up the other way. No, it's not. You should be taking it every day. Anyway, don't worry, it's fine. I will be better. I'll keep on it. So did you feel a little bit as well like, actually, I wonder it, in some ways, was the fact that menopause has got this sort of association of older women just having hot flashes, was that actually quite an unhelpful association when clearly what you're going through sounds actually really awful?
Oh, what, in terms of...
I suppose how people receive it and how also just actually the depth of what you're experiencing versus sort of...
That's a good point.
...version of what we know.
I forgot a big part of my symptoms was my anger as well.
So, I love the story about you going to the Ash reunion.
I mean, there are loads like that. There are lots I couldn't really include of me flipping out, but... So I suppose in response to what you just said, I think... like your period, they're kind of punchlines to jokes, the menopause
exactly,
and period. So
exactly.
With the menopause, it's you're hot and you're angry. And I definitely felt like a little bit of shame because I was now part of that crew. I mean, the anger, it is funny in retrospect because I am a very chilled out, peaceful human being in terms of my anger responses. It takes a lot to get me furious. But yeah, I was very angry. My husband had a lot of difficult interactions with me, and I just felt this desire to smash it up constantly.
Wow.
I'd want to just throw things against the wall, and I was confrontational, which I think is quite useful. And I think I've probably spent too much of my life not being like that. So I was quite, in some ways, I was quite into it, but. It was erratic and it was scary and, yeah, not nice to be around probably. And, I did push the men around at a gig. But then I was like, come on.
Yeah, I suppose with the anger thing, I think it's just when you feel like you're set to cross and then things just annoy you and then you're just highly irritable and in that mood where you don't really like how you're acting. That's the side of that mood that's really unpleasant.
Yeah, and it was all aimed at men.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it was all aimed at poor men. I'm sure they loved
because
being
they
pushed
wouldn't
out
have,
a bit.
Wouldn't go through that. Maybe?
Yeah. It is that. Yeah. Right, you nailed it.
Yes, and I think I know that feeling. And you, as you say, some of it's almost you sort of take at the time. It's almost take a bit of glee in just how angry you are. Fury. It's almost got its own, like, it's an energy source, isn't it? It's just when you know that you're doing it that's disproportionate and people are looking at you a bit like,
gross.
And you can't wind it back down.
You cannot,
you're just stuck.
Yeah.
So I guess it must have been a very intense time because it just hearing your diagnosis and dealing with what's happening with you is enough. But also back to baby.
Oh, yeah,
the baby. There was that became... the focus in terms of what the conversations you were having mainly.
Yeah.
And that the appointments you were having mainly.
Yeah, loads of... work were great and, understood. And you have to go to lots of appointments if you're doing any form of IVF. So I was in the hospital a lot. And we were all geared up to do the egg transfer in November 2017. So
this is from your sister?
Yeah. So my sister had 2 weeks of... doing those injections which stimulate your ovaries and get them all ready for being extracted. And then we all head off to the hospital one morning. Mark goes into a cubicle and does his business. I mean, actually, he did miss the cup and he had to scrape it off the wall. So my baby is technically the scrapings of a... it must be powerful. I mean, powerful stuff that he's got, really. So they then put it in, sorry, I'm so bad at explaining science stuff. My sister had her eggs removed and then they joined it up in a thing. Hang on, what's it called? They took my sister's eggs and my husband's sperm, put it in a laboratory and we waited overnight for it to fertilise. And you want to get a blastocyst, which is a really strong embryo. It's one that's most likely to survive. But we got a phone call the next day saying that We didn't actually have any. They'd all died overnight. So I was completely broken by that. And then the next day, we got another call saying, actually, something's changed overnight. You've got one. You've got a healthy embryo. Let's pop it in. So Mark and I rushed over and they put it in us, in me. And then you have to wait 2 weeks to find out if you're pregnant. So you're just very careful and you just don't touch anything and, you know, walk really slowly to work. But we didn't get pregnant that time. And it was really difficult telling my sister because the hormones are powerful. They actually do make you feel menopausal. So it was a lot for her to physically go through with two small boys. And it was really expensive. And I think we'd been prodded and regulated for so long that I just needed some time out. I was really sad. And my sister was ready for round two. She was like, we'll do it again. We'll go again. And I just thought, I can't put you through that. So we met a wonderful doctor and he said, this is through the NHS as well, he said, why don't you consider egg donation? I was really horrified by that. And I thought, that's disgusting. I don't want another woman's body inside mine.
Is that so? That was your first response, was just...
Yeah, just horrified. I didn't know anything about it. And it's stupid, really. But yeah, Mark was very pro it. This doctor was pro it. And I was really annoyed. I think I was also coming down off all the hormones and the stress of it all. So I just wanted everyone to leave me alone.
I suppose as well, your experience had been with your sister. And that's familiar. And there's already so much about that relationship that's... what you don't even need to articulate it. It's just there. So the idea of it being someone completely different...
That's true, yeah.
It's a really different thing to get your head around.
It is, and Libby and I are really similar, and I knew there wouldn't be any weirdness if our baby, you know, looked like her or behaved like her because, yeah, we've got a really uncomplicated relationship, my sister and I.
And that's always been the case.
Yeah.
That's so lovely. That's amazing. Love that.
She's a lot older than me, and I think she... It's just a good egg.
I like to see it all around, in all senses. that could be the name of a book, couldn't it? I think, I like to think I would do the same for my siblings as well, without even thinking about it as well. Yeah. I think that's something that happens with those people in your life that you have that bond with, definitely. It's not even a question mark. You just go, of course that's what should happen. Because you want... especially if your sister's already a mother and knows that's what you want. You just think, I want that for you, if that's what you want. I think that's quite an instinctive thing, really. And that's amazing that it affected her so much when she's got young kids as well. That must have been a lot to process. And probably at the time, there's all this momentum of the next appointment, how it all works. And it's only really now you can look back and think, wow, we actually did all that and it all happened. And
yeah, and I really have to, you know, I don't want her to ever feel like she failed because it wasn't anything to do with her. Just, you know, people go through fertility treatment for decades. It's brutal.
This is the thing that's so crazy, isn't it? We have, in so many ways, so much benefit of modern science, but that really, when it comes down to making that baby, it's still really tough to do.
It's a miracle.
Yeah.
Truly, it is a miracle. Yeah, it's bonkers.
It's not just add that to that and away you go. It is actually quite mind-blowing that there's so much that's kind of unknown about how that all works.
I know.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It is. And I sound quite flippant about it all. I'm sure lots of other people have difficult journeys sort of coming to terms with even using their siblings' sort of eggs or whatever, but felt very calm and just let's get on with it. But yeah, it did take me a while to process the next step, but I think I sort of had to shut a bit of my brain down and think, if I really want a child, this is the only option. And then, you know, would pursue adoption, obviously, but that would take a while as well. So I just had to sort of turn off any worries or weirdness I had going on. And Mark was really pro it. You know, the process would be very quick because we were going to...
Is he quite pragmatic about these sort of things then?
He is really pragmatic. And he's really good at, like, he doesn't play poker or anything, but he's good at knowing when to chuck everything at something.
Yeah, and he'd just be like, do we want to do this or not?
Yeah,
do you want a baby? This is how to get this. This might work, yeah.
Which is good because I'm not, you know, I'm not like that, so it was handy. And we were suggested a clinic in Spain. So we had a few phone consultations with them. They were really fast, really efficient. There wasn't, you know, it wasn't that touchy-feely or anything. They just asked me, do you want dark hair and light eyes, which is what I've got? And I said, yes, please. We didn't know anything about the donor. I think in some other clinics you can choose, you know, if they're good at chess or whatever, but...
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, I just wanted... I didn't, you know, I didn't need any additional information.
Choose if they're good at chess.
Or like, you know... Good
I would have just gone for someone who's quite tidy, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Just easy to live with, please.
It's so true, yeah.
Just easy going.
I know. Please. I think if you start down that route, you can just probably get lost. Like, what do you want? I mean, yeah. So
they don't, I mean, you don't have to say if it's too personal, but they don't go as far as like gender and things like that. Because I know Spain sometimes, that is a place where...
I didn't know that, no.
No, I think Spain is one of the countries where you can do... you can decide what gender baby you have.
Crikey, no.
It's not legal in the UK.
Wowza. No, I'd never heard of that. Hmm. Luckily, yeah, so we just went for it. And then Mark and I trotted off to Madrid for a weekend, which is when we were going to do the egg transfer. I hope I'm not skipping through stuff, but it was just sort of a boring story of taking hormones and getting, again, doing lots of scans to see if my womb was thick enough.
Hmm.
Which is really, actually, I'm really skipping over that, but it's really stressful. You have to have bleeds at a certain time. Your body has to do things like clockwork, and it's slow and boring and really stressful, which is like the worst combination.
What, getting yourself ready for everything?
Yeah, like, so by this date, you have to have a bleed, otherwise we won't be able to do the next stage, which is this. And some, blimey. You know, you're like willing yourself. I used to go for massages and stuff to try and relax my body so I might bleed at the right time. And
I actually didn't realise any of that.
It's a real faff.
And well, how does that affect your relationship with your body?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a very functional thing that you're just like, come on, please work.
Yeah.
I hated it a little bit.
But then I suppose in some ways as well, when things do happen and you're already, you kind of marvel at the fact that you can be sort of
big time
organised like that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think you can get a bit sort of fixated on being healthy and stuff like that. But I did go down that path. I did stop drinking and... I got really into hot yoga and did all that stuff just to more to sort of cushion myself. If it went wrong, I wouldn't get too upset. I'd be physically strong enough to sort of cope with stuff, which I think is quite important. But I don't think you need to not eat certain things and all that. I think just try and do whatever makes you calm and happy is my advice to anyone doing fertility treatment. Mark booked us into this hotel in the gay district in Madrid, which was... very funny because they were just like pumping EDM constantly and beds were like and massive bowls of condoms next to.
Did he like look? Was that
still a mystery?
It's got very good reviews on TripAdvisor.
It was it's a bit of a mystery why we ended up there, but I mean it was a good distraction, but it was just very central.
How incongruous it was quite a nice thing actually, because it was like, this is actually quite funny. It's quite sometimes quite nice to have those moments of absurdity in amongst things that are very intense.
Yeah,
and especially when it's very medicalized.
I agree. Yeah, there was nothing too sentimental about anything that was going on. It was
you don't
just...
go back and stay there once a year. Just to...
I would actually. I had a lovely rooftop bar, but we headed off to the clinic, and you have to have a full bladder, and it's quite a hard thing to sort of judge, because if you take it too far, then you know you're in agony. And they let me go for a wee just before I went in because I was about to wet myself in the reception. And then I had to drink about 7 pints of water, so I was back up to...
Is this for a scan?
This is for the implantation.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why you need to have a wee in your bladder, but it's, maybe...
I think I had to for my first scan. I think I don't think they do it anymore, but I think the first time I had a scan, you had to have a full bladder. And I think it's something to do with how it makes everything present when they're...
Right, it's more inflated.
Something like that. I don't know. I was about to try and say what it is, but I realised I don't know.
I didn't know anything. I mean, some women are really good at being on it. I just was like reacting to whatever was in front of me, to be honest.
Mm.
It was really slick and great. And they even showed us the little baby blastocyst on an iPad before we got it implanted. So I saw him.
And that's
at a very
reassuring,
young age.
Isn't it? That they've, this is just the thing that they get on with doing all the time.
Yeah, totally.
And there'll be, you know, appointments before you, appointments after you.
Yeah, definitely. And it was, you know, it was brilliant. And then went back, they popped it in me. Brilliant. It wasn't. They just stuck a thing inside my cervix or whatever. Don't even know where it went. Went back to the hotel, laid on the sort of silky leather sheets. And then went home. And 2 weeks later, I had a positive pregnancy test, which was brilliant.
Incredible. Yeah.
Pregnancy was great.
And then the next adventure begins.
Yeah. I mean, it was bad, actually, what happened. I didn't have space to write this in the piece, but I had... pregnancy was fine, actually. It was quite scary because, you know, if we did have a miscarriage, it would have been a very expensive road back to where we wanted to be. So it was, it was intense.
But suddenly you realise that vulnerability of just how far you've come and how invested you are, and then it's kind of out of your control aspects of it, and it's just...
You're screwed, yeah.
Just realise your heart could break very easily.
Yeah. It's a really vulnerable time. Mm. But it was, you know, nice... And nice being pregnant, and I was actually a bit more feisty in terms of getting people off tube seats than I thought I'd be. I thought, I'm only going to do this once, I'm really going to go for it. And then he was quite late, actually. Am I going to... is this interesting, what my birth and stuff?
You can if you like.
I'll be quick, but...
I need to do like minute by minute or anything.
Basically, it all just went a bit wrong. His heart rate was going really low. So they broke my waters and they pulled him out with forceps, and I had an episiotomy and all that stuff, and quite a bad tear. And then I had to go into theatre afterwards and sew me up. And then I couldn't breastfeed because it had all been so intense that I was slightly traumatised. And then... he got jaundice. We had to go back to hospital because obviously there was no milk coming out of my boobs. And then I spent a night in hospital with him, in which I was in a nappy filled with my own wee, and then my scars, I can't believe it. My scars from my episiotomy got infected, so I had to go back to hospital.
Oh, you poor thing.
And
that's
then
horrible.
Lockdown kicked off, and I was sort of trapped with all that. Get diagnosed with PTSD afterwards, but I think had I been around my family and friends to talk about how mad it all was, I would have gotten over it, but because I had to look after my baby and we were in lockdown, I just sort of internalised it all.
No, I think that's very honest of you, and I think I've actually had it with a few friends who've had really traumatic births, and invariably it's the first baby or the only baby or whatever, and then you go and visit them and both of them, like, you know, look like they've been sort of like in a war zone or something. They look absolutely shell-shocked. And obviously you've got this beautiful new baby in amongst it all, but I've seen it in my friend's eyes where they just look like something has, you know, happened that they can't quite process. And I think you're so caught up in this thing of the baby's here, and then the bit of the birth is almost just supposed to be like the anecdote you tell about how they made it onto the planet. But actually, if you have a traumatic birth, that is horrific. And if you think your baby might die in that moment, that's horrific. And if your partner thinks you might, all those things take a long time to even, because you're supposed to be just like, oh, we're into the next bit now. And how many weeks your baby? And there's so many other things to distract you. And you're now having to focus on this new person and being responsible for them. But I actually think there's a lot of things that take a long time to process.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe people don't even really ask you about it that much because you get discharged from hospital and then that's kind of, right, you're on to the next chapter now. Off you go.
Yeah.
Is everything okay with you physically? Okay, on you go. And actually, I think it's actually more unusual to not have an experience like that. I'm trying to think of anyone I know where it's just like, actually, you know, it was amazing. I'm actually struggling to think.
Yeah.
I think most of my girlfriends come away, you know, some of them have awful... blood loss and tears and all sorts of things, and it's just awful and defining and quite private as well, actually, because you're supposed to be just so elated that your baby's here.
Especially when you've had like such a big run-up to get the baby.
Yes.
I was like, oh no, I sound really ungrateful. And also, but I sort of, my feelings about it, I'm quite bitter about the aftermath of his birth because I was so... in shock and completely traumatised that I don't think I enjoyed those first few months of him being alive. And I'm really sad about that because I'm not going to do it again. And I feel like I've lost out on it.
No, you haven't. And no. I think that's really normal, I think, because so much of it is just such a big deal. And Actually, I spoke to another lady who'd, I think, spent 7 years doing IVF to have her baby. And she and her husband both had postnatal depression because this very long for baby, they just both... It was
wow,
just,
I've never heard of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, they both just were really unhappy in themselves for the first year because they just felt like we wanted this so much and now it's actually quite tough. And I don't know, there might have been other things going on and they just, both were really blue.
That's the thing about fertility treatment. The run-up is so exhausting that when you get to the toughest bit, you're already knackered. And again, I'm saying this from someone who only did it for 2 years, but yeah,
so if you're having
hard.
Your treatment in the UK, is it treated just like a normal pregnancy after that? Or do they look after you that bit more because they know your history?
Yeah, it's it was high risk because of that, but actually it was fine. There wasn't really any that.
So you have a few more appointments?
Yeah, yeah.
But is there sort of care in terms of like how you're feeling about everything?
That's a good question. Not really. I mean, it was more just like we'd prefer it if you had it in the hospital rather than a home birth, okay. Which is fine because I was up for that anyway. But yeah, no. I mean, I guess they just don't have time to be that touchy-feely about it, maybe.
I don't think it's touchy-feely to check if you're okay. I think it's just... It goes right to your core, a lot of this stuff, you know, and the emotions that come up. And actually, if you've already got, you know, a complicated journey that's been very medicalized, and then you also have a tricky birth, and then you also, I mean, lockdown, that's a whole other thing to add into the pot, isn't it? And I wonder how many people will be only just now articulating either, maybe even to themselves, how tricky that's all been, you know?
Yeah.
And you've spoken a lot about saying it's the only time you're going to do it. Is that a decision that was just an instinctive thing?
Yeah, like I'm not over any part of this journey yet. And you know how I think you were saying earlier, or maybe I was listening to someone else say it, people just forget about that hard bit at the start and have another one. But I mean, all of it was so hard that I just couldn't do it. I just could never do it again. And also he's enough. For me, definitely, like I feel like I've got him.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's okay, and yeah, I think particularly the birth.
And I think you're part of a pretty that club has got a lot of membership.
Yeah. I think so.
I know a few members, definitely. And also, what can happen is sometimes people decide to have another baby, and then it all comes up. And then they get very freaked out about the idea that they've got to deliver this baby no matter what and what will happen. I think maybe that's another discussion, really. I think there's just so many things that are only just being spoken about in a more conversational way rather than just behind closed doors, actually.
I know.
We've got such an idea of how we're supposed to feel, how we're supposed to take to it, what's supposed to come naturally, what's supposed to come easy. But actually, so many people fall into the footnotes at the bottom of the pregnancy books about what happens if you turn left instead of right. And then for you, you're just that paragraph is the only reference to it.
Yeah.
You know? And then you have to buy a different book after that.
Yeah, I know. You know, people are always like, oh, you shouldn't really talk about your birth story because it upsets other people. But it's like, why would you not talk about getting in a major car crash or...
Exactly.
You know, I think we've got to have a little chat about it occasionally, but I mean, I remember telling my friends about what had happened and they just, there was no one knew how to say it, to respond to it because the way I was saying it was unhinged and what I was saying was like horrible, talking about my dead baby in front of me. So it was just, he was alive after that, obviously, but he died for a bit. I just wanted to add as well that I did manage to relactate. I managed to get milk out of my boobs and we did it for 6 months. So.
How did you, what, like after a significant?
Yeah, it was after a month.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. It's horrible. On its own.
Really hard work, just pumping.
Yeah.
Pumping. And
I didn't actually know that could happen after a month.
Yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but we did it and I'm glad, you know, I'm definitely not evangelical about breastfeeding, but I'm glad I tried and glad we did it.
No, I'm just impressed at the human body, really.
Yeah, same.
And I think... I would not, you know, I think whether you're not, your breastfeed is like just so not interesting to me about other people. I don't care if you're breast or bottle at all. But I do think that particularly in very medicalized situations. So when I had my babies early, for example, I fixated a lot on the breastfeeding because it was the only thing I felt I could do that was just my job. And, you know, I could have had donor milk or formula, but it was something I could do that showed I'd just have a baby, even though my baby wasn't at home. So I'm very familiar with the pump.
Yeah.
Very familiar.
When you hear the noise of it, it's very triggering, isn't it?
Although they move with the times, those pumps, and now you get these very quiet ones, if you know that.
Really? I didn't know that.
It's really clever. It's all changed since the beginning for me. Where should I take this now? Because I think there's so many things that you've made me think about. But I suppose I love the idea that you're saying, here's enough. I think that's a really beautiful thing about your baby. I really love that. Mm. And my children will never listen to this, but that doesn't mean you're not enough, darling.
I'm in awe of other people who can do it again, to be honest. I think it's magical. But I mean, also the important thing to say is that I was really nervous about talking about my baby as a donor egg baby, because it's going to be a really complicated thing to explain to him one day, and I want him to understand it properly. But I think the overwhelming core of this is that he was so wanted.
Yeah.
He is the product of years of work and all of our money. He is everything. We put everything into getting him. And so I hope he knows that one day.
He knows it already.
Yeah.
when that's the environment you're born into, I think it's imbued in you, actually. And I don't... It's funny, I mean, I hope you don't take this as me being really flippant, but from where I'm sitting, it's just not that big a deal.
No, it's not.
I don't think about it like that at all, because this is just what happened on the way to you having your baby, but that baby is the baby you were meant to have.
It's, I know.
It's the only one you know. And it always feels like that, I think. I know.
It's all these secret... People have got all these secret stories about how they came to where they are, and we just are only just starting to talk about them more openly, really.
Yeah. But and also, I don't know if anyone would ever say anything otherwise, really. I think if anyone has an opinion that isn't like that, then it says a lot more about them than it would ever say about you.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
It's nothing to do with you, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, some people can be... It's always very revealing, I think, if people have got a very exacting idea of how things should go, and that's the right way. I don't follow that at all.
No.
Yeah. Life is a lot more complex than that, isn't it? I wanted to ask, because I know when you were saying that you were starting the process of trying to have a baby, that you were finding it really hard to be around, you know, pregnant people, babies, even family, kids' birthday parties. And I wondered, once you've had a baby and you've had a foot in that camp, do you feel like there's still a foot in that camp?
Yeah. And I don't want to ever, you know, you have to be careful to not take up all the space when you've been infertile and then you've had a baby, because there's obviously so many people who are still going through it. And I never want to be that kind of person who's still sort of trying to hoover up all the sympathy. But I definitely am really cautious about posting stuff on the internet and asking people about their own situations. And stuff like, if I still worked in an office, I might be a bit wary of bringing my child in, because something like that would ruin my week if someone brought in a new baby and I'd been having a tough time. So, yeah, I'm really a bit wary of showboating, even though you desperately want to do it because you're so proud of them. But yeah, being a bit delicate and not knowing anyone's backstory is key, I think, and I'll always have that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that when I spoke to Emma Barnett, who spent a really long time trying to have a baby, she has endometriosis and did IVF in the end, and she said she can't relate when women have had a really tough time getting pregnant and then end up posting a lot about babies and pregnancy and their children at home. And it wasn't even a judgment, it's just an emotional response. Like, I don't understand how you've now become into that camp.
It's tough, isn't it? Because I think it is just sublime pride and love. And I think it's coming from a really innocent place. But I also see completely Emma's side. It's sort of mad that we do the thing that hurt us the most to other people. Don't know, it's a minefield. The internet and babies is a minefield, and there's no rhyme or reason to it.
Babies and actually like lots of things, actually. Like how we, what we choose to share and what might actually have that effect on people, and you just have, you're not thinking it through in that way. But then if you worried about the people that might perceive it that way, or might, you probably wouldn't really post anything ever, because everything is just like, why are you saying, telling us about? I mean, I remember like last year, I was like, well, I can't post if I go on holiday, I won't share anything, because it felt like there's so many people who can't go away. You know what I mean? There's sometimes things kick in, and other times I've probably done like incredibly tactless things and not really thought about the people that might go, why are you doing that?
Oh, I spend like 3 hours debating whether or not I should put a picture of anything on the internet. It's horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting one, all that. I suppose it goes back to what we were saying before as well about aspects of motherhood being sort of held up on a pedestal, and then you worry that if you start going, actually, look at this amazing human, that you sort of become part of it. But actually, I think, as you say, it's really sensitive to understand as well that the reason people do it is coming out of is an innocent thing. You're just thinking, yay, look at my offspring.
And maybe they want to be part of this club that they felt excluded from, and they want to tell the world. And I think it's quite complex, really, the reason why we're motivated to do things on the internet.
Yeah. But that's interesting you said about even taking your baby to work or something would have been, like if that had happened at that time, that would have just been like...
Yeah. I was being hurt all the time and it was nobody's fault, but I was just hyper aware of it.
Yeah.
It felt very irrational for me. And just avoiding seeing my nieces and nephews was really tragic, really. Didn't like that aspect of it at all, but it was just self-protection mode, really. A bit selfish, but necessary.
No, if it hurts, it hurts. Mm. And you just need time to get to the point where you can be okay with that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And now he's here as well, which is lovely.
Yeah, he's ridiculous. He's got a really mad mullet.
See? A mad lockdown mullet.
Yeah.
Is that a result of you trying to cut his hair, or just the way it's styled?
My husband won't let me cut it. And it is magical, but it's just very straight hair. So he looks like we always compare it to sort of a greasy pub landlord sort of vibe.
Well, actually, Mickey, my youngest, has got really long hair, and I've never had one where I've just let his hair grow. But I think because lockdown and everything, because he was just over one when it started, so the time when I maybe would have taken for a haircut, and then by the time he was allowed to, it just became sort of part of how he looks now. So he's got really long hair. So they can hang out with their mad hairdos together. Like. I mean, on a good day, it looks lovely. On a bad day, it does look a little bit neglected. That's fine. He can just about see through it, so it's fine. I want to thank you so much for all your honesty. I honestly think these conversations are really important. And I think your article is so beautiful. And I'll make sure people head there. But you articulate it. There's so much love there, not just with you and your husband and your baby, but also I can hear it through your family. Yeah. It's just, it just shows you like how valuable that is to buoy you up, actually.
Yeah.
And I bet your friends have been really amazing too. And then they all know how special that is that he's here.
Yeah. He's going to be a little spoiled runt.
And with your sister, did it change anything afterwards in terms of your relationship? No.
Yeah, I think we've both gone through this really big thing together. It's definitely brought us closer. I just want to thank her every time I see her that she did that for me. But I don't know, I'm just forever indebted. Even if it didn't work out, it just was beautiful.
So that was lovely, Harriet. Doesn't she speak so beautifully about her experience? Really appreciated her time and her honesty. It's lovely to hang out with her and to speak with her. And yes, you're right, I'm still walking around Aberdeen. I've been a little bit silly, if I'm honest with you. Because I set off and I wasn't really thinking too much about where I was going. And I've wandered all over. And now I just want to be back at the hotel, but I've got to traipse quite a long way to get back. But you know, I suppose it's good for me. Although part of me is a bit like, I'm supposed to be taking things easy because on Tuesday, so where are we now? Saturday. Oh no, only 3 sleeps left. I'm going to do my 24-hour challenge for children in need. And I'm feeling a little peculiar about it because I'm not really sure if I'm supposed to have done any training or not.
I spoke this morning on Claudia Winkleman's Radio 2 show with her, and she said you can't train. And I spoke last week to Dermot O'Leary, and he said you can't train. But Professor Greg White, who is a physiotherapist, who'll be with me for the full 24 hours, he sent me some exercises to do a couple of weeks ago. I don't know about you, but I was like, yep, definitely. He's like, it's only about 15, 20 minutes a day, just core training. And I was so sure I was going to do that every day. And I don't think the five times I've done a plank since then really count. So I guess now my fate is sealed. I might as well just get on with it. But I don't know. I think I'm just going to be buoyed along by whatever it is that's going on at the same time. I just saw that Owain, the lovely Welsh weatherman, he's just completed a 24-hour drumathon, which I think is really hard. And it was really joyous. And he raised over £2 million. But I'm also a bit confused because he was allowed to have lots and lots of people come in and drum with him, which looked incredible, by the way. And I'm doing my dance-a-thon in the radio theatre, BBC Radio Theatre, and I'm not allowed any more than two people on stage with me, and they have to stay 3 metres away. And I'm not allowed to just have people drop in. So I'm like, how does this work? Who's making up these rules, baby? Anyway, don't worry. Well done to Owain, because he did brilliantly. And hey, it's all going in the same pot. And I'll do what I can. I'll dance through it. I'm a little bit nervous. It's all right, isn't it? Anyway, fingers crossed, next week I will have a podcast guest who very beautifully tessellates with my fundraising. I don't want to say any more than that, so I don't want to jinx it, but yes. Oh, thank you. I just got some slightly more senior women let me overtake them. I'm quite a fast walker. Quite like it. Get it done, I say. Anyway, I hope wherever you are and whatever you're doing with your day, hope you're good. Thanks for lending me your ears and your time. And when we speak again, I'll have done my challenge. Woo, it's going to feel good, baby. I want to be the other side of it now. Actually, I just want to be doing it. I kind of want to get on with it. And some of the songs in the playlist are really, really good. That's going to help. Anyway, lots of love to you. See you soon. Bye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres-Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.